The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегран.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 30th of March, these are our main stories. The Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, says Europe has entered a pre-war era, and no one on the continent will feel safe if Russia defeats Ukraine. A dissident Iranian journalist has been stabbed outside his home in London. There have been protests against the police in a Mexican town where an eight-year-old girl was murdered earlier this week. Also in this podcast...
If you have a legal trade, you're ensuring that communities can benefit, and you're also making sure that it's conducted in a manner that is scientifically sustainable from a conservation point of view.
The South African government has announced a new wildlife protection plan, which involves encouraging people to eat more animals. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has delivered a blunt warning that Europe has entered a pre-war era, and if Ukraine is defeated by Russia, no one on the continent will feel safe. War, he told European media, is a real threat. His remarks came as a fresh barrage of Russian missiles targeted Ukraine, taking out power supplies in three areas. Yuri Sak is an advisor to the Ukrainian Defence Ministry. He said the air defences that Ukraine has are effective, but they need more to protect people and infrastructure from those Russian missiles.
Unfortunately, we haven't been able to intercept all of them. As a result, there have been some hits on the energy infrastructure in different regions of Ukraine. It's quite easy to understand how terrible this is, because energy infrastructure, when it's knocked down, it means hospitals cannot work, it means banks cannot work, it means the whole country is put on hold in terms of economic activity.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is quoted in the Washington Post as saying Ukraine will have to retreat in small steps if it doesn't get more US support. The Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski says he went to the US recently to try to persuade Republicans in Congress to lift their bloc on approving more funding. He said it would provide much needed weapons.
I was trying to persuade the American public and the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives that the cost of deterring Putin after he conquers Ukraine will be much higher, because he would do to Ukraine what he's done to Donbas, which is to take the resources, both industrial and human, and use them against us. So it's better to help Ukraine now.
So who is Donald Tusk talking to when he says Europe is now on a pre-war footing? I asked our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
Well, he's talking to Western European NATO leaders. It's not the first time he and others in Eastern Europe have sounded the alarm, and it's getting ever more clarion, I think, because they are the ones closest to Russia. They are deeply alarmed by what's going on in Ukraine, by the fact that Russian ground forces are making steady but slow progress on the ground, pushing back Ukraine's forces. And they are appealing to Western NATO members, particularly people like Spain, for example. They're not spending the 2% mandated of GDP per capita on defence, saying, if you don't spend it now, it's going to be a great deal more expensive to try and confront and defend against a newly reinvigorated Russian army if they manage to conquer the whole of Ukraine.
We've seen a lot more energy infrastructure damaged in the last few hours. Is what we're seeing playing out now Russia winning in the way that everyone expected at the very start of this conflict?
Not quite, because I think even Western military experts thought Kyiv is not going to be able to hold out, that it could just be days before it folds. There were two big surprises. One is the resilience of the Ukrainians as to how hard and well they fought back in those early days in 2022. And secondly, the surprising unanimity amongst Western NATO partners in coming together and giving Ukraine a lot of the help that it needed. And now Ukraine is pushed back onto the defensive as Russian forces are pushing slowly westwards. The one area where Ukraine is doing well is in the maritime domain in the Black Sea, where its long-range uncrewed vessels like drones underwater and above the water are wreaking havoc amongst Russia's navy. But that isn't changing the fact that the Russian Air Force is bombarding Ukraine's cities, its defences, its power structure, its villages, its people. And on the ground, Ukraine's forces are losing territory. It's a pretty depressing picture.
And if Donald Tusk's audience are other Western leaders, what does he want them to do? I mean, he wants them to maintain focus and spending on defence.
Really, what Donald Tusk is saying is echoing the warnings by other East European nations, the ones that are closest to Russia, which is that you need to radically upgrade how much you spend on defence. He's appealing to them to open up what's left of their armouries, rush this stuff through in support of what Ukraine's own leaders are saying. The problem is that so far away from the front line as we are here in places like London, Paris, and of course, you know, Washington and Ottawa, it all feels a very long way away, and we've got many other pressing priorities, cost of living, take priority in most people's minds. And governments, they haven't got a lot of money to spare on this. They've already spent billions on helping to defend Ukraine. It didn't do the job. And I think there is a feeling in some quarters, well, maybe it's a lost cause. Maybe we just need to settle for some kind of a bargain, some kind of a pact to stop the war and hope that the problem all goes away. East European nations, including Poland, are saying that is delusional, because a pact with Putin isn't worth the paper it's written on. He will simply go away, reconstitute his army, and come back and take the rest of Ukraine, or worse, at a future date.
Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to send a team to a new round of Gaza ceasefire talks taking place in Doha and Cairo. He was speaking hours after separate Israeli air raids in Lebanon and Syria killed two Hezbollah leaders. Here's David Bamford.
Israel's Defence Minister Yoav Gallant warned that Israel will strike at Hezbollah anywhere and everywhere, in Beirut, Damascus and in more distant places. Hours earlier, the Israeli military said it had killed the deputy commander of Hezbollah's rocket unit and seven others east of Tyre in southern Lebanon. Earlier, Hezbollah said its senior commander Ahmed Shahimi was among six fighters killed in an attack near Aleppo Airport in Syria. 36 Syrian soldiers were also killed, the highest number in a single recent raid. Russia and Iran described the attack on Syria as a violation of international law.
In Jerusalem, there's been an uneasy calm as Palestinians marked Good Friday and Ramadan. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, is there.
The Good Friday procession along Via Dolorosa, where Christians believe Jesus carried his cross to his crucifixion, was smaller than usual without the foreign pilgrims who cancelled their trips because of the war. It's also Ramadan for Muslims and next month Passover for Jews. In Jerusalem, religion is inextricably linked with power, identity and nationhood, this year sharpened by the war in Gaza. In the procession was a Palestinian Christian activist, Rafi Gattas.
All the Palestinian people are suffering today. They're suffering from occupation, they're suffering from apartheid, they're suffering from genocide. And today what we are praying is stop these disaster situation here in the land of peace, in the land of Palestine. So we are praying to have our own resurrection today and the resurrection of our land, Palestine.
Well, the procession has entered the Holy Sepulchre Church, which Christians believe was the site of the crucifixion of Jesus. As ever in this church, it's pretty chaotic, a lot of pushing and shoving, but also a strong sense of spirituality because, you know, Jerusalem is a city of true believers. The people of Jerusalem, of all faiths, are locked in a crisis as bad as any since Israel's independence war in 1948. Religion offers certainty and answers, but in this holy city, prayers and peace plans have not put a dent in this immutable conflict.
Counter-terrorism police in London are investigating the stabbing of a Persian language TV presenter. Pouria Zarati works for Iran International, a news channel which is critical of the Iranian authorities. He was stabbed in the leg outside his home. According to the TV station, police had previously warned of credible threats to the lives of two other presenters and their families. My colleague Julian Marshall spoke to the BBC's Kasra Naji and asked him for more on the TV presenter and the news channel he worked on.
He's a very high-profile presenter of Iran International. And as you said, Iran International is broadcasting in Persian to Iran, very critical of the Iranian authorities, like an opposition, really opposition channel to Iran. And therefore, the suspicion falls on the Iranian government, the agents of the Iranian government that might be behind this. But let me tell you what the police are saying, the Met Police, a spokesman, saying that while we are keeping an open mind, given the occupation of the victim and our publicized concerns about the threat to the employees of that organization, he means Iran International, the investigation is being led by the Counterterrorism Command. The spokesman goes on to say, I must stress that at this early stage of our investigation, we don't know the reason why the victim was attacked, and that would be there could be a number of explanations for this. He goes on to say, I appreciate the wider concern this incident may cause, particularly amongst others in similar lines of work and those from Iranian communities. Of course, the police are saying that they are appealing for any more information on this.
And what word on the condition of the presenter?
Iran International says that he is in a stable condition in hospital, and the police are saying that his injuries are not life-threatening. From what I understand, I spoke to some sources in the Iran International, and they're saying that he was stabbed in the leg and in the foot several times. And it seems that whoever did this, maybe they did not intend to kill.
And very briefly, Kasra, I mean, Britain is certainly of the view that there are Iranian officials and others who are part of international criminal gangs linked to Iran who are involved in threats to kill journalists on British soil.
That's right. In fact, last month, we had the British government imposing sanctions on Iranian officials and others it said were part of an international criminal gang linked to Iran who were involved in threats to kill journalists on British soil. Don't forget that two other presenters of Iran International previously had received death threats, serious death threats, and a colleague of mine in the BBC Persian has also received serious threats.
Kasra Naji from BBC Persian. Relatives of an 8-year-old girl murdered in southern Mexico have joined residents of the town of Taxco to protest against the police and demand justice for the victim. The case has caused outrage in Mexico, which has one of the world's highest rates of violence against women. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
Camila Gomez disappeared on Wednesday after entering a neighbor's house in the southern Mexican town of Taxco to use a swimming pool. Her mother went to the police a few hours later after receiving phone messages demanding a ransom to free her. She says she gave the police images from the security camera of another neighbor showing the house where the girl was, but they ignored her pleas to act. Camila's body was found on a local road on Thursday. Residents then attacked the three suspect killers: a woman who died in hospital, and two men who survived the beating. The town's Good Friday religious procession was called off.
The South African government has come up with a novel strategy to protect its wildlife. It wants people to eat more of the animals. The Ministry of Environment aims to increase its game meat industry sixfold by the year 2036. Here's our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
In an interview with the BBC, South Africa's Environment Minister, Barbara Creasy, said there are vast tracts of marginal land on the outskirts of national parks that could be used for game ranching for animals such as antelope, buffalo and zebra. She said the plan would increase the value of the meat, help preserve the animals' habitat and bring much-needed revenue to poor communities. Just as some countries are experimenting with the legalization of drugs, she also believes that legalizing game hunting will help combat poaching.
What we think is that there needs to be a legal trade, not an illegal trade, because obviously if you have a legal trade, you're ensuring that communities can benefit and you're also making sure that it's conducted in a manner that is scientifically sustainable from a conservation point of view. it's not a situation where one is saying that anybody can come along and take a pot shot. The landowners themselves would be determining, in consultation with scientific authorities, the sustainable offtake.
Barbara Creasy says it's also an opportunity to boost black ownership of wildlife areas. 3 decades since the end of apartheid, only 3.5% of such land is owned by historically disadvantaged South Africans. In a nation that's devoted to its barbecues or braais, game meat could also provide a more carbon-friendly alternative to beef, as antelope, buffalo and zebra generate less methane than cows. They also don't require clearing forest land that serves as a natural carbon sink. Oh, and although you might not imagine munching a zebra burger anytime soon, this leaner meat is actually healthier for your body too.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And still to come.
In its heyday, Life was the single most popular magazine in America. It taught generations of Americans how to look at photographs.
Life magazine, a 20th century mainstay famous for its photojournalism, is to be revived.
Water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The always febrile world of politics in Northern Ireland has been rocked with the news that the leader of the main Protestant pro-Britain party has been charged with rape and other historical sexual offences. Geoffrey Donaldson has now stepped down as the leader of the Democratic Unionists. He denies the charges. An unnamed woman has also been arrested. Strict British laws in cases involving allegations of sex crimes mean most details can't be reported. Sir Geoffrey His sudden resignation comes weeks after he steered the DUP back into a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin, ending a 2-year boycott of Northern Ireland's devolved institutions. Our Ireland correspondent Sarah Geervin reports from Belfast.
The Police Service of Northern Ireland said a 61-year-old man had been charged with non-recent sexual offences. A 57-year-old woman was arrested at the same time and charged with aiding and abetting additional offences. A statement said the pair are due to appear in court next month. Hours later, the Democratic Unionist Party said Sir Geoffrey Donaldson would be stepping down as leader with immediate effect after confirming he'd been charged with allegations of an historical nature. BBC News understands Sir Geoffrey has been charged with rape and other sexual offences after 2 women came forward. The DUP said he's also been suspended as a member of the party, pending the outcome of a judicial process. It's thought a police investigation began a number of months ago. The East Belfast MP Gavin Robinson has been named as the DUP's interim leader.
I think it's been a devastating revelation and has caused tremendous shock, not just for myself personally or my colleagues within the DUP, but for the community right across Northern Ireland. It came as a great shock. But we are a party and individuals that believe in justice. We have faith in our criminal justice system.
The former Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith told the BBC he didn't believe the news would affect Northern Ireland's devolved government, which returned earlier this year after a 2-year hiatus.
With the election of Gavin Robinson as interim leader, I'm not concerned in any way that this shocking news today will lead to any change in the momentum behind power sharing.
Sir Geoffrey's resignation letter to the DUP states he will be strenuously contesting the charges against him.
The COVID-19 pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and problems with global shipping routes have all led firms to source products closer to home, or as it's called, reshore their supply chains. But the director of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, says that could threaten global growth. Dr. Okonjo-Iweala told my colleague Will Bain that current WTO free trade rules had lifted many people out of poverty.
We are where we are today
You know, poverty from the 1980s, when we had the percentage of people living under absolute poverty at about 55, we're down to 10% today. That is living below $2.15 a day using World Bank figures. We're at about 10% today, 2022 figures. And a lot of that progress has been due to trade and the free, fair and open trading system that was created. So we mustn't forget, when there are these troubles that are emerging, to try and start throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's what we're cautioning. So, of course, we are concerned when protectionist measures start coming in to sound the alarm to countries that be careful, because, you know, creeping protectionism, large subsidies, all these measures that may not support competition can lead to a race to the bottom.
And how do you sell that message as a leader?
There's been this worry during the pandemic. You know, it's a sincere worry that supply chains were disrupted and there was difficulty with getting supplies. That led to a feeling of let's reshore, let's onshore supply chains. And some of that will inevitably happen. But we are warning too much of that could also lead to fragmentation. It doesn't build resilience. Fragmented trading world means everyone loses. And if the world fragments into two trading blocks, it could lead to a 5% loss in global GDP in the longer term. For developing countries, it will be double-digit losses. This is nothing that anyone wants to think about. So I also want to point out that 75% of world trade takes place under WTO terms. So when I hear people knocking the WTO, I just smile because I always say it's like the air you breathe. So you don't treasure it until you find yourself in a room with no oxygen. You don't treasure the WTO and the multilateral trading system till you find it's not there. And then it's going to be chaos.
And that was the director of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. The COVID-19 pandemic officially claimed 7 million lives and cost the world economy $2 trillion. As it abated, almost all countries agreed the world needed to come together to prepare for and try to prevent the next pandemic. And for the last 2 years, member states of the World Health Organization have been working on a pandemic agreement. But with a deadline looming next month, there's still no sign of any consensus after a ninth and supposedly final round of negotiations in Geneva. Nina Schwalbe is founder of the public health think tank Spark Street Advisors in New York. James Menendez asked her what the agreement is meant to do.
The pandemic treaty is about countries' obligations to each other before, during, and after a pandemic so that everyone everywhere is better protected next time. They're trying to agree on everything from diversification of vaccine production to equitable distribution of countermeasures like vaccines and drugs to conditionalities around R&D funding, meaning when the public pays for funding, should those products be available at a concessional price, access to pathogens and genetic materials, and overall principles of what's being called equity, being fair to everyone everywhere.
And is it a legally binding treaty?
Yes, the agreement will be a legally binding treaty, but depending on how it's adopted, it's either an opt-in or an opt-out.
But how might it be enforced? I mean, are there penalties involved?
For those countries that do decide to be part of it, we're hoping that there'll be some sort of compliance mechanism built into the treaty so that countries are held accountable for their commitments.
So what are the sticking points? What's holding up agreement on this?
All member states and countries seem to agree to this principle of equity, but the devil is in the details. So the sticking points are, how do we diversify vaccine manufacturing and production? Who pays for it? How do we actually share pathogens? How do we make sure that when a high-income country produces vaccines that are based on genetic material provided by the Global South, how does the Global South get access to those products? There are a lot of details yet to be worked out.
How urgent is this?
The next pandemic could strike this afternoon. It could strike tomorrow. The thing is, nobody knows. And everybody in the world has learned lessons from COVID. So preparation should happen now.
I mean, is it as ever about money? Because presumably some of these things like surveillance and monitoring of emerging pathogens, or if there is an outbreak, that does cost money. And is it poorer countries saying we need help to do it?
Low-income countries, developing countries have made clear that there has to be money available to support the commitments. And that is a sticky point in the discussions.
And to what extent are the vested interests of the drug companies holding things up?
The drug companies are playing a big role in these negotiations, and you can see that particularly in the positions of some of the high-income countries that have significant pharmaceutical industries.
Do you think an agreement is going to be reached, and will it be the sort of agreement that is going to be effective? Because I've read some criticism saying in the hurry to get something on paper, because as you say, the next pandemic could strike today, that actually it'll end up being a bit watered down and not very effective at all.
I spent the last week watching the negotiations. Nobody's interested in a weak instrument. And the question is the issues that still need to be negotiated. The member states have made clear, and the World Health Organization and the Director General of the World Health Organization, that they need to get there by May. And there's really no option for a what if.
Now, the legendary American magazine Life, a 20th century mainstay famous for its photography, is to be revived. Created in 1883 and then bought and overhauled in 1936, Life was long a flagship of photojournalism, publishing images captured by huge talents like Robert Capa and Margaret Bourke White. From movie stars to wars, Life chronicled the times for decades. After years of decline, it went monthly and then survived online. But now it's returning to print. Julian Marshall spoke to Bill Shapiro, a former editor of Life and founding editor of Life.com.
In its heyday, Life was the single most popular magazine in America. It quite simply defined news and culture for Americans for decades. And on top of that, really taught generations of Americans how to look at photographs.
And you say how to look at photographs, and those photographs were, on the whole, quite extraordinary, were they not?
They were. I mean, Life, during its heyday, lasting for decades, had, you know, the best photographers in the United States and arguably throughout the world making pictures for it on a weekly basis, and they were extraordinary.
Was it ever afraid to shock Americans? I'm talking here about the Vietnam War.
You know, Life loved its celebrity coverage and it loved its cultural coverage, but it liked also to show what was going on in the world. And that meant the Vietnam War in color, brought to America by photographers like Larry Burroughs. But it also meant civil rights photographs, you know, in the South during, you know, years of racial segregation and tension in this country. So it didn't necessarily like to shock readers, but it wasn't afraid to.
And do you think there is still an appetite for a magazine full of those kinds of graphic photos when people can access so many images online?
Well, what I think Life brought to its readers was a curated sensibility. And yes, there are millions of pictures available online, but they're not brought to you in the same way or from the same voice and sort of guiding perspective. And that's what Life magazine did so well. So they would have celebrity maybe on the cover, but then they would have some hard-hitting stories later and human interest and things that would make you laugh and cry and feel something. So a lot of it has to do with the editorial voice and the curation.
Bill Shapiro, former editor of Life magazine. Beyoncé has released her much-anticipated country album Cowboy Carter to widespread acclaim. She describes it as a deeper dive into the history of country music, and it's helped to highlight other black artists in the genre stereotypically seen as white. The US-based Black Opry is one organisation hoping the Beyoncé effect will help other artists. Sophie Williams caught up with its founder, Holly G.
This ain't Texas. Texas Hold'em made Beyoncé the first black woman to reach number one in the country Billboard charts. And now she's releasing her hotly anticipated country album. Last week, she told fans that the criticism she faced when she first entered the country genre had forced her to challenge herself and create the album. Country is a very white-dominated genre, and Holly G from the Black Opry has been trying to change that in recent years.
I was just somebody who was a huge fan of country music, and I got really frustrated not seeing myself represented in the genre. If you look at the people that were in the music videos, the artists, the people that were hosting the TV shows, even the marketing material, you didn't see black people represented anywhere.
Black Opry is an organisation that gives black artists and fans a space, promoting their work by hosting concerts and tours. It aims to stop black people in the industry from being overlooked and disregarded. For Holly, it's important to change the way in which country music is perceived.
There have been black people making country music since before the industry existed. If you look back to like when the Grand Ole Opry started, a lot of those artists were learning country music from the black people around them. It has been centered around white people, mostly white men. And so you have this long-standing history of tradition that centers around one type of person. And that inherently creates obstacles because you're constantly being told that this is what country music looks like. And if you don't fit into this mold, you can't do it the right way.
A study by Dr. Jada Watson at the University of Ottawa found that from 2002 until 2023, 96.5% of songs played on country music radio were by white artists. Songs by women of colour averaged just 0.6% of plays. But now, many black country artists have seen streams and plays of their music up hundreds of percent since Beyoncé released her two country tracks.
What's up? My name's Tiara Kennedy, and this is my show. I'm a singer-songwriter living out my country music dreams right here in Nashville, Tennessee.
Musician and podcaster Tiara Kennedy says she has seen plays of her own music increase.
I've already seen the effect personally just through my music and through socials. Posted a little cover of Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, and just seeing the response from that has been really cool. I'm thankful for her presence in country music because I feel like she's really changing the game for a lot of artists.
So could this focus on black country artists last beyond Beyoncé's album?
I love going through the comments on my videos and seeing all of the people that are fans of Beyoncé that haven't always listened to country music, but now because she's doing country, they're like, okay, I need to get over on this bandwagon. I think it's not just a moment that's happening. I think that it's going to have residual effects, and I think there are fans that are going to be sticking around for a long time.
And that was Tiara Kennedy with Sophie Williams. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Hannah Montgomery. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.